Good morning. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Leonard Hawk. A lot of you recognize Dr. Hawk, who's frequently seen around the hospital. He is a Chief Medical Officer of Trussbridge Palliative and Advanced Illness Management. Until the merger of Hospice by the Sea and Hospice of Palm Beach County, he has served as Chief Medical Officer for Hospice by the Sea. Prior to coming to South Palm Beach County, he was in private internal medicine practice in Kansas City for more than 25 years. He has a special focus and interest in geriatric medicine and end-of-life care with board certifications in internal medicine, geriatrics, and hospice palliative care. He was recognized as a leader in the care of frail and geriatric patients through his commitment. He was invited to become a member of the Missouri Best Practices Committee with the Division of Aging. In 2007, with his interest in hospice palliative care, resulted in the development of a palliative case management model for acute care hospitals. This was implemented in Research Medical Center in Kansas City in 2008 and has been proven to be successful in decreasing the length of stay and acute care costs while increasing the comfort measures for the end-of-life patients, support to family members. During his medical career in Kansas City, Dr. Hawk was the healthcare reporter for Fox 4 Television News. He also is a veteran. He served his country in Vietnam as an Army medic. He attended Kansas City College of Osteopathic Medicine, graduating in 1976, and completed his internship in Dallas and his internal medicine residency in Kansas City. In 2009, he was elected as a Master Fellow in the Gilliam Society of Master Fellows. This membership is the highest honor awarded by the American College of Osteopathic Internists for outstanding contribution and service in his profession. This morning, Dr. Hawk is going to tell us about the best way to manage acute pain. Please join me
Thank
in
you.
Welcoming Dr. Hawk.
Thank you. Thanks. So acute pain management. Today, we're going to talk about acute pain management really in the hospital setting. It could also be in the hospice setting, but it is acute pain management. We're going to go through this rather quickly. These slides are available, and I'm always available and can talk more about references and resources. So for those of you who are advanced residents and practicing physicians, this will be a review. For the medical students and beginning residents, this will be a set of pearls, just little clues and pearls. In 40 minutes or so, it's just impossible to go through all of the details of acute pain management. Develop and be able to control pain in the hospital environment. Pain is the issue, not the prescription pad or the order sheet. We're often limited in our culture and our thinking about, I'm not going to put any more of that opioid, that medication on my prescription pad. It is, after all, about the patient and their pain. Learn a few pearls to manage acute pain. And palliative care is not the pain service. It's the symptom management service. Pain is one symptom. We'd like to consider ourselves symptom experts, not just pain experts. Pain is an uncomfortable sensation divided into acute, chronic, nociceptive pain. Nociceptive pain can be chronic or acute, somatic or visceral, neuropathic pain. Acute pain, new onset, usually within days. It can be post-surgical pain, a broken hip, injury, fall. It can be longer lasting pain, cancer pain, metastatic pain, and non-cancer pain, which can be nociceptive, somatic, visceral, or neuropathic. The etiology can often be identified in acute pain, and we should look for that. If pain had its onset within the last few weeks, if we can find the etiology of that, pathologic fracture, gallstones, pleurisy, then it's important for us to attempt to identify the etiology and take care of the pain by mitigating that illness or condition. Chronic pain, very long lasting, usually greater than 6 weeks, it's often difficult to identify the etiology. We should probably try to look for it, but it's often difficult. The emotional overlay is often difficult to assess the degree of pain, and there are always concerns that the patient is manipulating us for pain, chronic back pain, chronic somatic pain, that we feel somewhat at risk. But for them, it still hurts. Nociceptive pain, normal nerves with tissue injury, somatic muscles and joints, visceral, internal deep cramping wave, squeezing pain, splenic swelling, gallbladder inflammation, pancreatitis, capsular stretching or inflammation causes this visceral pain. Neuropathic pain or abnormal nerves for all the reasons, for diabetes mellitus, for compression, neuropathy, for myelin sheath degeneration disorders. And it's often described as burning, tingling, radiating, lancinating, shooting pain. Pain can be graded from very mild, 1 to 3 on a 10 scale, moderate, 4 to 7 on the 10 scale, and severe is 8 to 10. Although patients will tell us it's a 15 on a 10 scale, the scale goes to 10. So severe pain is 10. 10 pain is the kind of pain that people would come immediately to the hospital for. If the pain is not relieved, they sometimes say they would rather die than continue with this kind of pain. Acute pain treatment. We're talking about pain management in the hospital. So only a few days or even a few weeks of treatment are necessary. It doesn't turn into chronic pain. Mild medications, Tylenol, ibuprofen, non-steroidals perhaps for the very mild pain, somatic or visceral nociceptive pain, even neuropathic pain. Moderate potency medications for moderate pain and opioids for severe pain. Chronic pain management that lasts quite a long time, difficult situation, still categorized as mild, moderate, and severe. Medications that we use all the time, aspirin, still willow bark, still works. Tylenol, Ultram, codeine. Codeine's interesting. As a young doc, it was Tylenol number 3 or 4, 2 orally every 4 hours, PRN pain. Codeine is a great antitussive. It helps with cough. It's pretty lousy for pain. It will help actually mitigate diarrhea in appropriate circumstances. But codeine is metabolized through many stages and turns out to be a teeny tiny dose of morphine effective analgesic equivalent. Hydrocodone, morphine, oxycodone, hydromorphone, duragesic, and there are, of course, others. These are common medications from mild to quite potent. Obstacles to pain management are culture and concern. My Dr. Bennett in medical school said, you own that prescription pad and don't let the nurse, the patient, or their family tell you what to write. It is the prescription pad that matters. That was one of the untruths I heard in medical school. It's the patient that matters, not the prescription pad. If we haven't comforted them, then we have not done our job as physicians and providers, practitioners. So cultural concerns, not on my... And it's increased all the time. So every 2 years our license comes due, and we have to check or not check the box that said chronic pain prescriber. You know that box? Well, that meant that many, many physicians don't check that box for chronic pain prescriber. Back when I was in Kansas City, the Attorney General of the state went after doctors for writing prescriptions. One of my associates had his license on the line for writing Tylenol number 3, number 100, 3 times a day or every 8 hours if needed for pain. In Missouri and other states, they have a State Department, a Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, and the rule was you could not write a prescription for more than 1 month. So in a 31-day month, every 8 hours PRN would be what, 93 and he wrote a prescription for 100, and the Attorney General had the State Board of Licensure come and investigate him, make him come to the Capitol to explain why he was breaking the law in Missouri. And the culture then that William Webster, I want to mention his name because he deserves to be recognized as a hostile person, and actually went to jail later on for another reason. The state attorney general had a motto that doctors were dealers, not healers. And certainly in Florida in the past with the pill mills, that could have been a motto here. But conscientious doctors and nurse practitioners and PAs of great integrity would be threatened if the culture was to attack prescribers, chronic pain prescribers, doctors as dealers, not healers. And there is a culture to hold back on completely comforting our patients. Tylenol, so one of the obstacles to pain management, if we ordered Tylenol number 3, what would be the limitation to pain management? It is that Tylenol, 4 grams a day, used to be the top of the therapeutic window. Then 3 grams in geriatric patients, the top is 2 grams. And in liver disease, it's not at all. Narcotics and opioids require our DEA number, and there's pushback, physician hesitation, state laws and regulation, and always the concern of addiction, which does happen, but happens rarely when the object of our prescribing is to control the pain. Addiction comes up all the time. Even in our palliative and hospice setting, we hear the 75-year-old daughter of the 97-year-old mother who's got metastatic disease and 3 days to live, I don't want her to become addicted. And we hear that all the time. With younger people, with chronic disease, people without life-limiting prognosis, that addiction is a concern. So the common words that you all know, tolerance is the expected result of using any medication. The mitochondria start to adjust to that, and the pharmacokinetics change. So if morphine 2 milligrams was an effective dose 3 weeks from now, the same effect may require 4 milligrams. And that is not addiction. That is expected tolerance. We should be prepared to increase the dose to achieve the same level of palliation or comfort. Dependence is very interesting for me that, well, they depend on that medicine to relieve their pain. Well, we depend on antihypertensives to control our blood pressure. We don't get it under control, then stop the medicine. We depend on insulin and an insulin-dependent diabetic to control their sugar. A surveyor in a nursing home here in Florida 2 years ago came in and cited the nursing home for prescribing an antidepressant to a lady. And when the surveyor talked to the resident of the nursing home, the lady said, "No, I don't feel depressed anymore. I'm pretty happy. I engage in bingo. I go to salon on Tuesdays and have my hair done." And the nursing home was cited for having a non-depressed lady on antidepressants. That, for me, that is like saying if your sugar's 120, you should be cited for having them on insulin. It makes sense that the treatment was appropriate and effective. Addiction is the non-medical, unrelenting pursuit of the substance, usually an opioid or a narcotic, non-medical, unrelenting search for this substance which does harm. Harm to tissues, harm to organs, harm to systems, harm to work, harm to relationships, harm to organizational capacity. Addiction is the unrelenting seeking of a substance for non-medical purposes that does harm. Tissue harm, organ harm, system harm, relationship harm, family harm, work harm, social harm. So that is addiction. Principles of pain management. So find the dose that works. This is how we would start. If a patient comes in with any example, it could be postoperative pain, trauma pain. Let's say it's cancer metastatic pain, bone pain, and we're the first that are going to treat this pain. So start off with short, potent but short-acting pain medications every 4 hour, every 6 hour. Give it frequently, but check frequently during that first that 24-hour period to be sure you're achieving. 2 milligrams every 4 hours, and you never check back to see if it's taken an 8 level down to a 5 is not appropriate. You really need to check, have the nurses check, have your team check, the on-call person check to make sure that this has alleviated, mitigated, palliated the pain, and it's improved. And if it's not improved, increase the dose. So the rule of thumb is if they're still having mild to moderate pain, 1 to 4, you increase the dose by 25%. If they're having moderate, 4 to 7 pain, increase the dose by 50%. And if they're still having almost no effect from the medication, still having intense pain, increase the dose by 100%. So 2 milligrams in that case would go to 4 milligrams. Frequency does matter. They can get relief, but if we scheduled at PRN every 4 hours and they have 3 hours of comfort and the last hour of distress, then we need to change it to match their distress. It is about the patient and comforting them. So once we have arrived at a dose potency that's appropriate, not sedating, but effective, when we've achieved the frequency that's appropriate for them, and the frequency can be very close. It can be every 30 minutes, every hour, every 2 hours, every 3 hours, dose and frequency. After 24 hours, calculate the total dose. Often we use the morphine equivalent dose in severe pain. And at that point, start a longer acting. So if they had a short acting Roxanol under their tongue, and they can still swallow, we would take an equivalent dose, perhaps, of MS Contin, continuous release, and divide it into two or three doses that would be equal to the 24-hour dose, leave a PRN dose in place. The PRN dose is usually, generally, about 15% of the total daily dose, and leave that PRN in place at the frequency that works for breakthrough pain. And at the end of that 24 hours, the patient should be comfortable. If they're not comfortable, we will talk about adjusting. So there you go. So long acting after the first 24 hours to match the morphine equivalent dose of the PRNs in the first 24 hours, and that long acting can be oral, it can be topical, it could be even a PCA pump in the hospital, and then adjust the dose as needed. So 10 milligrams of IV morphine is equal to 30 milligrams of oral morphine. 1.5 milligrams of IV dilaudid is equal to 7.5 milligrams orally. And hydrocodone, 30 milligrams orally is equal to morphine, 30 milligrams orally. So if we put someone on Vicodin or Lortab, hydrocodone, which is, by the way, always attached to something else, hydrocodone doesn't exist alone unless you have it compounded. So it is Vicodin or Lortab attached to Tylenol. It's the Tylenol that's the rate-limiting dose. But it is interesting that just the connotation of morphine is so powerful that we have people tell us all the time, we want mother's pain control, but don't start her on morphine, because morphine has such a negative connotation. I had a hospice patient, still independent and functional, on 2 milligrams of morphine, half a cc of Roxanol, 2.5 milligrams of morphine, 3 or 4 times a day as needed for pain, and that was effective. They went to the community doctor, and the community doctor said, morphine, my God, it'll suppress your respirations. They're going to kill you. Why would they start morphine? Let me start you on Vicodin. I'll start you on 5,500, 2 tabs every 6 hours PRN. So they quadrupled my equal analgesic dose and gave a near life-threatening dose of Tylenol. But they got rid of the morphine. And it's important to realize, I think the teaching pearl here is that equal analgesics, and you can quickly, we used to have charts and graphs that we had to memorize for our boards and for our clinical practice, but now on up-to-date, Hippocrates, Medscape, your pharmacy can quickly give you an equal analgesic dose. Let me just ask, if a person was on 2 milligrams, a common dose of Dilaudid, IV, every 6 hours, and it controlled their pain, and we were going to discharge them home with a prescription of morphine, 2 milligrams of Dilaudid, IV, to how much morphine, PO, would be the equal analgesic dose? How much? 2? It would be 40. Whoa! It may constrict their pupils, but it dilates ours. Because, look at IV Dilaudid. 1.5 milligrams of IV Dilaudid is equal to 30 milligrams of PO morphine. So that's a 20-to-1 ratio, right? So that 20-to-1 ratio, if they were on 2 milligrams of Dilaudid IV, it would be 40 milligrams of PO morphine. Now, you may not change that. That may be a little bit stunning and say, whoa, I want to give a bit less than that, so do. But then stay in touch with the patient, because if it's not effective, you need to quickly get to the dose that's right. So let me just ask, 40 milligrams of morphine is an eye-opener, I think, in my practice for Ann, George, Joanne that work in palliative and hospice. It's not unusual at all. What is the therapeutic window? What's the top dose of morphine that we can prescribe? There is none. That's right. There is none. You can go until the patient is either symptomatic with that, anxious, have that histamine release, the serotonin effect, whether they're lethargic, sedated, too constipated, but side effects, or until you've controlled the pain. But there is no upper limit on that dose. So the therapeutic window of Tylenol used to be 4 grams, probably should be 3, 2 in geriatric patients, none in liver disease. Aspirin, until their stomach bleeds or their ears ring, it's about 4 grams. Ultram, probably 400 milligrams. Morphine, none. Hydromorphone, Dilaudid, none. So it is the mild to moderate pain drugs that have the therapeutic window and upper limit. But for the opioids, there is no upper limit. It's pain control or symptom, uncomfortable symptoms. There are multiple opioid receptors. The only reason that I mention this is because if you do have symptoms, uncomfortable symptoms, adverse drug effect, and you need to change the opioid, and opioid rotation is the answer, not stop the opioids, but change, you're very likely to capture new opioid receptors. So as we're looking at the equal analgesic dosing, we may want to reduce a bit because now we're going to capture new receptors. It's one of the whole concepts of using methadone. Methadone captures receptors that other opioids do not. And there are 2 important principles of methadone. One is it has a biphasic process of elimination. So, one, you can decrease the dose of methadone anytime at any rate, but you should only increase the dose of methadone every 3 to 5 days. If you start methadone and your patient is absolutely comfortable the next day, it's probably too much methadone. The day after and the day after, they're very likely to be sedate. So only increase the dose every 3 to 5 days. You can decrease the dose or stop it anytime at any rate. The other factor is because methadone incorporates other opioid receptors, that the higher dose of the opioid, Dilaudid or morphine, probably the lower dose of methadone. So if somebody was on 40 milligrams of morphine 3 times a day, I might start if it needed to come off of that because of any reason, including adverse symptoms, uncomfortable effects of the opioid, and I were going to start methadone, which is very effective and very inexpensive, I would probably start 2.5 milligrams orally every 8 to 12 hours. Keep them on a rescue dose of morphine. Don't stop everything else. We can't allow them to be in pain. But 3 days later, if they say, I feel quite a bit better, but not completely, if they're still having 4 or 5 level pain, you can increase that 2.5 milligrams of methadone to 5. So two principles. Decrease methadone anytime, increase it every 3 to 5 days. The other is start very low, and then every 3 to 5 days, if needed, you can increase. Always leave rescue medicine in place. Opioid rotation is the answer. If someone has adverse effects of the opioids, then you should not stop them and allow pain. You should rotate to another, and you can rotate to another using equal analgesic effect and crossover effect. So you'd look at equal analgesic, drop the dose slightly because of incorporation of new opioid receptors with the new medicine, and then monitor closely until you have the desired effect. So histamine release, sweating, itching, nausea is not an allergic reaction. It's expected, this effect from morphine especially, Dilaudid, and fentanyl, and others, is usually a temporary effect, 3 days, and they're comfortable with that. They will feel a little druggy effect, a little anxiety that should also resolve as their pain resolves. Constipation never goes away. So our saint in palliative care said, the hand that writes the opioid writes the bowel program. So if you're going to write for morphine or Dilaudid or fentanyl, hydrocodone, write for a softener, a PRN laxative. So just like if we make someone NPO, put a nasogastric tube down, the next order is an IV or a method of hydration. If you write an opioid, the next order is a bowel program. Can't write an opioid without a bowel program. Respiratory depression, I hear every day that I visit the ICU, well, we'd like to use Dilaudid or morphine, but we can't. It'll suppress their respiration. This is really a myth. You have to depress the sensorium before you suppress respirations. So Dr. Ochsner said morphine is God's gift to man in pulmonary disease. It decreases. Morphine is an excellent analgesic, excellent. It has two other incredibly beneficial effects. One is it decreases the sense of suffocation. And when we get those bronchiectasis, pulmonary fibrosis, COPD patients who are gasping for air in the hospital and come to hospice, morphine in the first day will calm their sense of breathlessness to a point they can actually function and be comfortable. Too much morphine causes sedation, and with sedation can come respiratory depression. In an awake patient, morphine will not depress the respiration. Sensorium first, and then respiratory depression. Methadone, it's been touted being great for neuropathic pain. In the last 4 or 5 years, I think that's gone away. Pain is pain. Methadone will work for any pain, and any opioid will comfort any pain. Start with a very low dose, adjust every 3 to 5 days. If comfortable on day one, the dose is probably too high. Fentanyl patch is fat-loving, lipophilic. It can still be effective in skinny people, just have to use a higher dose. It's temperature sensitive. If you have a little nursing home patient with chronic pain and they're in an icy, cold, air-conditioned room, they'll have less effect. If they sit out in the Florida sunshine and the sun shines on their patch, they can have a fentanyl overdose. This happens. 24 hours to achieve an effect on or off. So when you put it on, you still have to do rescue doses of something until 24 hours and the fentanyl is fully effective. And when you stop the dose, it still contained in the fat for at least 24 hours, and so don't expect an immediate. And change the patch every 72 hours is what the prescription or order should say, not apply. It's embarrassing to have your patient come back to the office a week later and have four fentanyl patches stuck on because you didn't say change, you only said apply. So that's important. Other than opioids, adjunctive, non-analgesic medications, antidepressants, anxiolytics are very effective. There is almost always anxiety, depression, emotional overlay to pain, whether it's acute or chronic. Non-medications, diversion and distraction therapy, also can be very effective. Physical therapy, occupational therapy for comfort, not for rehabilitation, but for palliation, TENS units, ice packs, massage can be very effective. Distraction therapy, movies, Oprah, bingo, going to the salon, pet therapy, music therapy can all be helpful. Dose adjustments. So if this patient is on medicine, you've done that first 24 to 48 hours, and the patient is still having pain, increase the dose by 25% for mild, 50% for moderate, 100%. And in the last year, we've even seen if they're still having 10 over 10 pain after you've had that first 24 hours, increase it by 200%. So you'd go from 2 to 8 milligrams of morphine or Dilaudid. Seems like a lot and fast, but we're seeing that now. Adjust the long-acting dose. You look at your 24-hour morphine equivalent and adjust the long-acting dose, the fentanyl patch, the methadone, the long-acting morphine. PCA pump, you'd increase the foundation or the basal rate and then increase the breakthrough dose and or frequency. So that was a quick review or some pearls about pain management. I have a few more minutes, and I wanted to talk about another topic that we hear about and that's in front of us all of the time, not related to acute pain management. And if I did say anything that you would like me to talk about more or that you have questions about, I'm always available. Readmissions. I think all of us have heard about readmissions, and for many years now, readmission penalties to hospitals. Now, it doesn't affect really any of us because no nurse, no APRN, no PA, and no physician yet has been imposed a penalty. But hospitals have, and it's becoming quite serious. So I don't expect you all to become experts, but I want to let you have a little bit of information about readmissions. So become conversant in the language of avoidable readmissions. Understand and be able to use knowledge gained here to reduce readmissions. So readmissions are expensive. CMS in 2017, the last year that CMS presents us, spent $706 billion. I think actually it's been adjusted since I made this sign. It's $709 billion on all of Medicare. $709 billion. Now, that's Medicare A. Medicare A are hospitals, skilled care, and hospice facilities. Medicare B is us, providers. Medicare D is the prescription drug program. Anybody know what Medicare C is? Medicare C is the Med Advantage programs when insurance companies contract with Medicare to buy the Medicare benefit. So every day on television, when we don't have the personal injury lawyer commercials, the other commercials are for Humana, Medicare A, AARP program, Blue Cross Blue Shield. So it's the Medicare Advantage program. This is Medicare managed by an insurance company. And it's actually very beneficial to the patients because Medicare doesn't allow for important things like dentures, hearing aids, glasses, but these additional programs can. So Medicare A, facilities, hospital, skilled care, hospice, Medicare B, providers, PAs, nurse practitioners, physicians. Medicare C is the contracted Medicare Advantage, and Medicare D is the prescription drug program. All total in 2017, $706 or $9 billion spent. Readmission estimates on the lowest ever was $17 billion, but 5% of the Medicare recipients spend half of the Medicare dollars. You know, the over 65 population is only 13 or 14% of the total population, but they take almost half, 43 to 45% of the prescription medications. So the older population is the healthcare consumer, and that's certainly true of Medicare. But inside of Medicare, half of all the Medicare dollars are spent. It's been reported, supported, and denied that this is actually true, but it's an impressive number that 5% of the Medicare beneficiaries spend half of that $706 billion. Where are those 5%? Where's the most expensive care? Emergency rooms, med-surg, ICU, surgery department, oncology clinics, right? That dialysis clinics. That's the most expensive. So 5% spend half of the Medicare dollars. The hospital, and where do they spend it? Hospitals. So would Medicare be wise to reduce the readmissions to hospitals? So this started in 2012, 1.5% penalties to hospitals for acute myocardial infarctions, congestive heart failure, and pneumonia. CMS contracted with vendors, bounty hunters, to come out and find hospitals that had readmissions and be sure this penalty occurred. Now, back in 2012, 13, 14, 15, hospital leaders, administrative, CEOs, CFOs, financial officers, didn't care about no stinking 1.5% penalty because they got paid on heads in bed, census. They wanted census. So when we went out and said there are ways to reduce this, I'm one of the leads in Florida on avoidable readmission reduction. When we went out and talked to hospitals about this, they didn't care. We'll pay the 1.5% penalty. We'll take them back. We'll readmit them because the admission pay is so much more valuable to us. Times, they are a-changing. So the Health Service Advisory Group is the vendor in Florida that I work with, and there are county and regional coalitions looking at Boca Hospital. So how does Florida rate in readmissions? There are 52 states and territories ranked for readmissions. And where do you think Florida sits for the highest readmission rate? Where? Bottom. Florida is now 51 at the bottom. We were 52, but Guam dropped out, so we moved up a space. But we're still lousy. So the 30-day readmission rate in Florida, and probably so for Boca Hospital, Delray, Bethesda, is right at 19%. 30-day readmission rate for Medicare patients. The 7-day readmission rate is 35%. One-third of the Medicare patients discharged from the hospital will return within 1 week. And you can ask case management, the discharge planner, who they are, and they're going to say they'll be back tomorrow. And they'll be right. And they'll be correct. We are the worst in the country. Almost every hospital is receiving a penalty, and it's no longer 1.5%. It's now 3% for more than 3 diagnoses, expected in the next couple of years to be up to 6% for any diagnosis. But now, expected to increase for all diagnoses, and now nursing homes and skilled care are starting to receive a penalty as well. 80% of skilled facilities are receiving a penalty on their payer system, which is called value-based purchasing. and it's expected to go up. And unfortunate for hospitals, because after they're discharged, we're still held accountable as Boca Hospital Del Rey in Bethesda. No matter what they do out there, we're held accountable and penalized. In skilled care, for the next 30 days, if that's a hip rehab for 2 days, and that patient is discharged to home with physical therapy, and 3 weeks later comes back to the hospital, the nursing home is still held accountable and will have a penalty put on them. So this is how to stop it. One, so this coalition has been at it since 2012, and if you've got the great idea, here's your chance. If you want to be the one to invent the solution to this, you will be a gazillionaire. So they said, well, let's look at what we can do. So communication or handoff, seamless transitions of care. So if physicians could talk to physicians, if the hospitalist or the surgeon could talk to the skilled care medical director or the community office-based physician, they would be able to talk about their concerns, the diagnosis, and the treatment plan, right? How often do you think physician-to-physician communication occurs at a hospital discharge? Never. That's right. Facility to facility. If the hospital, the case manager, discharge planner, or the RN taking care of that patient could talk to the unit manager at the skilled care facility or the clinical manager in the doctor's office clinic, then perhaps that seamless transition and wonderful communication, what the patient's problems were, how they were non-compliant with their medications, could make a difference. How often do you think facility-to-facility communication occurs? Almost never. Transfer forms, the 3008 form, the discharge form that the residents and hospitalists fill out, or the case managers fill out and the doctors sign off, a great discharge summary, a great transfer form with all the medications that go to the doctor's office after the patient leaves the hospital, goes to the home health agency, would be a great vehicle to improve communication. And those forms do get there most of the time, but they're almost valueless. If you look what a patient leaves with, they leave with a half of ream of paper, 7 pages are how to take milk of magnesia effectively, and finding the diagnosis or a real impressive care plan and a follow-up, you have to dig through it, and good luck if you can find it. So these transfer forms have been invented. In fact, Dr. Oslander has Interact 2, which is probably the best in the country. And when it comes to the hospital or from the hospital, it often has the patient's name on it and not much other information. Incredibly valuable form, not handed. But communication would be a great way to reduce avoidable. How about medication reconciliations? That if the patient takes the right medicines the right way with follow-up, that will be, you know, the two categories of medications that bring any patient, readmission or initially, to the emergency room are the diabetic meds, and it's for hypoglycemia, or the anticoagulants, and it's for bleeding. So it's the negative effect of those two medications. But any med that's not taken correctly is a problem. So medication reconciliation. And we know post-acute visits, labs, that visits that occur within 3 days reduce the readmission rate by half. Visits that occur at 14 days after the admission reduce the readmission by 20%. So visits, getting the patient to the office or getting the doctor, the nurse practitioner, or the PA to the patient, will make a difference, but it doesn't make enough difference. The brightest of the bright, this is the Ivy League school, said, well, let's identify the root cause of the potential readmission for every patient. They couldn't afford their prescriptions. They didn't want to take them. They had prescription illiteracy. They didn't have family support. Their opioids were diverted by their grandson. Do you think we do root cause analysis for readmission for any patient, let alone every patient? The answer is no. Nobody does it, not even at those Ivy League hospitals. Or optimize the transition of care by getting patient-family engagement. So we do teaching tools. We have all sorts of milk of magnesia, how to take it in 7 pages of their discharge paperwork. but it's not effective in getting patients and families educated to do the right thing all the time. And that's what needs to be done. So that doesn't work. So where is Florida now after we've done all that? We're still 51 of 51. We're still at the bottom. And why? Because all of these things are not enough. They don't work. They don't work. One thing does seem to work. The physician doesn't, physician to physician, facility to facility, transfer forms, medications are always a mess. When I was a young doc, it was all their medications plus the paper sack under their bed and the medications left over from their dead husband. They didn't want to get rid of those because they might use them someday. Today, it's the public's bag. We don't do paper sacks anymore. It's all the bottles in the public's sack. Half of them expired in 2003, but they still have them. So all of those things I talked about don't happen. So here's the LACE scoring, similar to the INTERACT. So this is a tool we can use to identify who's going to be the long-stay patient. The length of stay in the hospital, the longer the length of stay, the higher the likelihood that patient is going to come right back. A 3-day length of stay, uncomplicated, discharged, unlikely to come back. A 35-day length of stay, very likely to come back. Pretty simple. And you all see this all the time. Do patients who have been with us for 35 days bounce as they leave the hospital? They do not. We take their energy out of them. And there's all studies, how many days in bed decreased their physical ability by what percent. We know that. So acuity is very easily, was it an elective admission or an emergency department admission? If it was an elective admission, they're more likely not to come back. If it was an emergency department admission, then they're very likely to come back. So let's say there's a stage 4 cancer patient that's electively admitted to have some chemotherapy or procedure done. That patient is in the midst of a treatment program doing pretty well. If that stage 4 cancer patient comes through the emergency room, that means they're acutely ill on top of their cancer illness, and they're more likely to be sicker and to be readmitted. C is the most difficult. How many comorbidities or complexities do they have? And the more comorbidities or organ system damage, the more likely they are to be readmitted. And the number of emergency department visits they had in the 6 months prior to this admission is a high predictor not only of their readmission, but of their life's prognosis. We use that. If you've had more than 3 admissions to the hospital, if you're over 65 and you've had more than 3 admissions to the hospital in the last 3 months, you might want to talk to hospice. Just the number of admissions to the emergency room. The caring criteria is only for the emergency department. It's valuable. So cancer stage 4 through the emergency room. This is not an elective admission in the midst of a treatment plan. This is a sick cancer patient, urgently sick. More than 2 admissions in the past year when this was published in 2006. Now it's probably more than 3 in a season, in a quarter. A resident of a nursing home, nobody plans in their retirement to go to a nursing home. It's not in your retirement plan. These people already have performance decline, cognitive decline, physical decline. So if you come from a nursing home to the emergency room, not an elective admission, then you're likely to be very sick. And an ICU stay, if you're back in the hospital, back in the emergency room, within 30 days of an ICU stay, you're very likely to die, let alone to be readmitted if you're discharged from this admission. Non-cancer diagnosis already in hospice. You say, why would any hospice patient be in the emergency department? But people with COPD, respiratory failure, they say, I never want to be intubated again. I never want a ventilator ever. It's in my living will, my pulse form, my advanced directives. But when they're suffocating, 911 is quicker than 1-800-HOSPICE. And so they're very likely to be back in the emergency department. So no labs, no x-rays. This is primary first 5 minutes in the emergency department, triage questioning. Why are you here? Stage 4 cancer. How many times have you been here? Where did you come from? Have you been in the hospital in the last month in the ICU? And are you on hospice care? Very quick, no labs, no x-rays, super fast. And these people if they're admitted, are very likely to have a readmission. So, and guidelines. So caring in that cute, C-A-R-I-N-G, guidelines. Predictors of life-limiting conditions and readmission opportunities. So perfect care after the hospital, it's not been achievable, wouldn't make a difference if somebody is at the end of their life. So what can be done? Anybody have that idea? Anybody want to be that gazillionaire right away? All of these things, we can't give up on them because they seem like the right part of a protocol. So the answer is continue to strive for perfection, communication, follow-up, care, the right medications at the right time for the right reason, and check it. There's actually a program in Broward County called Dovetail that the pharmacists actually reconcile medications continuously on a select group of researched patients that have been discharged from the hospital. Ask the patient what they want. That's the answer. Ask the patient what they want. You've been in the hospital twice. Do you want to go back? Where would you like to be? How do you feel about your condition? What's important to you today about? I got that from Ann Donnelly, who's taught me many things. Ask the patient how they are and what they want and see what happens. This actually does work. What do you think of your condition? After all that you've been through, what's important to you today? Is it to have your PICC line moved and be admitted again? Or is it something else? Because if it is have your PICC line moved, we can do it. We're great PICC line movers. We can do that. We can do dialysis. We can have them Levofed. We have buckets of it down in the pharmacy. We can put you on Presidex. You name it, we can do it. And if that's what you want, we can do that. If you want something else, tell us what you want. Where would you want to be? Hospital or home? Who would you want to be with you? The intensivist or your family? Now, we have some lovely intensivists. And here in Boca, we have some contrary families. So you'd need to ask. Where would you want your, and would you want medical care and attention? Not coming to the hospital does not mean doing nothing. It means doing what the patient tells you that they want to do. If they have constipation, if they don't want to eat, if they have pain, taking care of them can be quite vigorous in their care. So how to ask them? Sit down. Don't tell them. We talk all the time. I talked till I was blue in the face and they didn't understand. Have you ever heard a doc say that? I don't know what's happened with that family. You know, I think they're a low intellectual family. They got a thick skull. We have all these metaphors for why they didn't understand us. And what we need to do is ask them so we can understand them. Do you want to go to the ICU or do you want something else? How do you feel about your situation? What's important to you? What kind of care do you want? Not for the end of your life. What kind of care do you want for the rest of your life? And listen, 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 listen. Asking them works. So APRNs at Yale, no doctors involved, nurse practitioners only, finally got permission from physicians. Physicians are often barriers to this conversation. This is my last slide. The APRNs ask the patients and their families exactly those questions. Tell us about yourself. Tell us about your condition. What have you gone through? How do you feel about your condition now? What would be important to you? Where do you want to be? Who do you want to be with you? How would you like your care? And they were able to bring that admission rate. We're at 18.9% in Florida and probably here at Boca Hospital Del Rey in Bethesda. They were at 14.5% there. And in this 100 patients that they just ask, what do you want, they reduced the readmission rate to 3.8%. Just asking the patient what they wanted. And if they're cognitively compromised and can't answer, then we ask their family. But we do not ask their family, what do you want us to do for your mother, for your husband, for your brother? Because that puts guilt, responsibility, accountability, and burden on them. We ask them, if your loved one could be in this conversation with us, they can't because they're cognitively compromised, but if they could be in this conversation with us, that bright, decisive, bossy person that they were, what would they think of their condition? What would they tell us? What would they want? the principle of substituted judgment. So we should get 2 hours of CME for this fast pace. Thank you all so much for being here today. Thank you. Thank you. Questions or comments about either acute pain management or avoidable readmissions? So let me just say, physicians are now going to be next in line. If you took care of a patient in the hospital, Medicare is looking at how to penalize you. Yes, sir. That's every patient all the time. That's exactly right. Like the telephone game, you start the conversation. By the time you've talked to 10 people, it's totally different. That's exactly right. If we only focused on medication for readmission, I tried to do a lot quick just to have a high level of awareness for you, but medications are a total mess for exactly what you say. And even if we can reconcile it perfectly, which is imperfect, but if we could, patients and their families then alter and massage their medications any way they choose to. They take half a pill instead of the whole pill. They take it once a day instead of twice a day. Medications are a huge mess. Our fault, their fault, no fault, it just happens. Yes, sir. Yeah, Connecticut, where this study was, they were about 14.5%. Actually, it's pretty narrow, from 14.5% to us at nearly 19% of discharges are readmitted within 30 days. So it's a pretty narrow scope. It's not like anybody is doing 5% and we're doing 20. So believe me, Medicare's looking at that, Health Services Advisory Group. That is the question. What's the hospital across town doing that we aren't, so that they're 17.5 and we're 18.9? We look at that continuously, and there is no one clear-cut answer. The one answer is ask the patients what they want. Ask that. That's one difference. Yes, sir. Loving.
Loving and having the means, it was exhausting. Also being privy to a phone call to their primary physicians, I frankly will tell you I was appalled by the conversations. I must tell you, as a professional, so.
Well, you live in the same world I do. And if you're exhausted, think how that family is. They never get to go home at the end of the day. And they're trying to process. Did you see that in the readmission, I did not say, explain the clinical circumstance to the patient? That is not ever helpful to talk about their glomerular filtration rate, their ejection fraction, their delta-aminolevulinic acid level. It's never helpful. What is helpful is don't tell them, ask them, how do you feel about how you're doing? How are we doing for you? I tell you, I love you. For 40 years, you've been my friend, my resource. But doc, I mean, I'm using your example of your friend. You said you knew this person for 40 years. But I tell you, doc, I can't do it anymore. Oh, okay, what do you want to do? I never want to go to the hospital again, but I'd like to be comfortable. So can that happen? I mean, is that possible? Ask them what they want. Don't tell them what we know. Ask them what they want. Yes, Liliana.
Thank you.
You know, right here, sitting in our audience, we have the premier, smartest guy in the country with Interact 2. Joe Oslander has got this together. And if everybody would use, this is long-term care, not necessarily home health or a community-based physician, and we're often appalled by them, but if we use the Interact 2 form completely, there would probably be very few avoidable readmissions. The problem is it's a perfect vehicle developed over many years by a genius, but it's not used. And so our admission rate is still this way. Thank you all so much for being here. It's always a pleasure to be here. Thank you.